Welcome to Season 2 of The Great Humbling. My name's Dugald Hine. I'm a writer and co-founder of a school called Home. Through the strange spring of 2020, I kept a weekly appointment with the futurist Ed Gillespie, where we would puzzle our way through the stories taking shape around the pandemic and how all this fits into a longer arc of social, political, and ecological crisis. We called these conversations The Great Humbling because we started from a sense that this is a time of being humbled, brought down to earth. And we wanted to ask what happens if we approach the moment we're in on those terms. Now we're back for a second season, where each week we'll be taking a state of mind that seems to be part of the mix of being alive just now. So this is The Great Humbling Season 2, Altered States. States of being, states of consciousness, and of course, the literal alteration of our nation states. Thanks for listening. Okay, episode 8. We're back for the last time this season, the last time in this year of 2020. But where are we? How do we wrap things up? What sort of condition is our condition in? Do you want to break it to people, Ed?
Well, it's definitely the first time Kenny Rogers has been referenced in The Great Humbling, Dougald. Well, this morning's thick London fog feels eerily apt. I think, you know, we know that fog is about obscurity and indistinction. And biblically speaking, it's often an image that precedes great revelations. You know, it's that kind of grey zone between reality and unreality and uncertainty about the future and beyond. And I think it can also represent death and isolation. But this week, we're in a state of limbo.
You know, I've got an image of a low bar, a really low bar. And people managing to get even lower. And somehow it seems an appropriate image just now.
Yeah, well, actually in limbo, the bar apparently originally started low and then got higher. But we'll come to that. I was wondering, have you actually slept yet, Dougald?
I did stay up most of the night. I think it was about 4 a.m. when I finally crawled into bed in the spare room to spare Anna from getting woken up by me, or actually save me from getting woken up in the morning. Very kindly, she sat Alfie down in front of the TV so that he wouldn't come and wake me up. So I managed to get a whole 5 hours sleep on election night.
Luxury.
I was sat up and I found myself thinking, how many more times am I going to do this? Partly that's just because when you're past 40, you should think that about anything that comes around every few years. But partly it was a sense of a ritual that's lost its relation to reality, that actually getting caught up in the fervency of everything that's going on around an election. And I felt this particularly seeing everybody's posts on social media over the last couple of days, isn't doing the work of engaging with what the world needs, isn't even doing the work of engaging with democracy. I felt a bit like somebody who's lost their faith but still goes to church at Christmas. And I wondered if I would be doing that again next year. Anyway, before we get into the limbo dance, what have you been reading, watching, and listening to, Ed? What's been getting you thinking?
Well, I have to say, the last week, I've not read much except court papers. It was the final round of hearings in my long, long-standing family court battle. And I won't talk about that in detail, apart from the outcome was as good as could have been hoped. But there's something interesting about the limbo of the law and feeling that whilst those wheels turn inexorably slowly, hopefully they generally get you into the right position. You know, the law can be stodgy and protracted, but hopefully ultimately does serve. So I feel like I'm emerging from that legal limbo that I've been stuck in for almost 3 years. The key thing I watched, which actually was incredibly powerful, was a little clip from that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez shared from Professor Eddie Glauder of the African-American Studies at Princeton, which is an extraordinary interview he was giving on one of the news channels, where he's talking about some of the themes that we touched on last week in State of Jeopardy around Trump being the first white American president. And Professor Glauder just said white Americans are having to confront the danger of their innocence to break through the comfortable myths and stories that they tell themselves to protect themselves from the darker aspects of their history. And it was an extraordinary interview where he said, you know, Trump is not the issue. He's the ugliest manifestation of something that is in us. And that's not going to go away after whatever final outcome we get to.
So apart from staying up to watch the American election results, where my head has been this week has been a lot to do with preparing for this climate sessions series around the dark matter of climate change, all of the stuff that science can't help us to fathom that needs to be at the table. And it's taken me into the territory of myth and mystery that we talk about quite a bit in these conversations. And I found myself rereading Alan Garner's novel Boneland, which is presented slightly mischievously by its publishers as the concluding volume in the Weirdstone trilogy. Now, if you haven't read Garner, then you should, but maybe there'll be quite a few people who, as a child, read The Weirdstone of Brisingamen and The Moon of Gomrath, which were his first two novels. And this is kind of 50 years later, Garner comes back and writes this book, which, yes, in a way is picking up the story of those books. But if you go and look on Amazon, you'll find it's one of these things where it's got a mixture of 5-star and 1-star reviews. And there are people who have innocently expected that this was going to fit with the element of a kind of page-turning romp of a childhood favorite book. And then they're presented with something much darker and stranger, and for some people, maybe more impenetrable. And there's a relationship here to Neil Gaiman's The Ocean at the End of the Lane that I talked about the other week, because that is this book that's a children's book for grown-ups. Boneland is kind of like that, but much more brutal. And in a sense, Garner's been doing this for a long time. He sometimes said that the only 20th century novelist he has any time for was William Golding. And if Lord of the Flies took the children on a desert island genre of jolly children's fiction and put a stake through its heart, so that really it took until the Hunger Games for a writer to come along and figure out what you could still do with that genre. And in the same way, though perhaps not with quite the same effect, Garner's third novel, Elidor, took what you might call the Narnia genre. You know, children go through a portal into a magical world, and turned it inside out, showed its darkness, showed the toxic quality of that being seduced by the other world rather than growing into the world in which we actually find ourselves. Boneland is kind of about lots of things, but partly it's about what would it actually do to you as an adult to have lived through the kind of things that happened to a child in a fantasy novel. You know, how traumatized and messed up would you be if you had stumbled through a wardrobe into another world and then been separated from one of your siblings because they weren't allowed to stay in the magical kingdom, like happens at the end of the Narnia series? And there's even, like, the central character has a scar from being struck by a lightning bolt, which I think is probably a Harry Potter reference. But there is a story that's told within Boneland, a Hindu parable that touches on one of the themes that's been running through this series. And so I just wanted to read that bit to you. One day, Vishnu is sitting alone on the top of Chomolungma, the highest of mountains, and crying. And along comes Hanuman, the monkey god, and he says, "Why are you crying? And what are all those ants down there on the earth so excited about?" "They're not ants," says Vishnu, "they're people. I was holding the jewel of absolute wisdom, and I dropped it, and it fell into the world and broke. Everybody down there has got a tiny splinter of it, but they each think they've got the whole thing, and they're all running around and shouting and telling each other, but no one is listening." And there's a trick in here, which is that when we tell a story like that, maybe we imagine that we're moving into Vishnu's perspective, where you can see all of the fragments and step back and see them from above, but we're still just ants picking up shards, thinking that we have the whole. We don't have Vishnu's perspective. We don't have the angel of history's perspective, that satellite's eye view, which Stuart Brand and the whole earth promised would lead to a shift to a higher state of consciousness, doesn't help us that much. Because that's not where we are. That's not what it's like to be down here mucking about. We're somewhere else.
We're in limbo. And as always, it's good to do the spade work and the excavation of the etymology of the word, which I think might illuminate some of this. It comes from the medieval Latin limbus, which means hem or border, the edge or boundary, which always brings to mind something Martin Shaw says about change coming from the trembling edge. And it's obviously from the same root as where we get limen or threshold, which is where we get liminal, that sort of that space of possibility. Dante talked about limbo as the first circle of hell, which is where the virtuous pagans hang out. And there's a strange ambiguity to it because, you know, those who inhabit limbo, it's actually brightly lit and it's sort of a beautiful but sombre castle. But there's never the possibility to get to full enlightenment. It's the lip of hell. And it always reminds me of a story when I was doing my round the world trip without flying, and I was on a ferry back from Japan to China, and the only other English-speaking Westerner on the ferry was an American evangelical guy. And obviously, when there's only two of you on a ferry, you inevitably sort of end up talking together. And for 48 hours, we had this sort of interesting ecumenical debate, let's say. And I was essentially saying to him, I was like, "Well, look, you know, I totally respect your beliefs, and I am essentially someone who is not aligned with any of the kind of the major Abrahamic faiths or any of the other religions. But, you know, I do try to lead a good and virtuous life, do to others as you would have done by, but, you know, broadly speaking, where does that leave me in the eyes of your God?" And I just remember this guy sort of pausing and just looking at me and then saying, "You'll burn for all eternity in the lake of fire." I'm thinking, well, thanks for that. But also it's where, you know, limbo is where the souls of unbaptized infants go, which has created all sorts of debate in the Catholic Church. It's also the limbo of the patriarchs, for those who died in friendship of God but could not ascend into heaven until the redemption of Christ. And maybe we should stick the entire patriarchy in limbo. But there's also this sense that it's an uncertain period of awaiting a decision or resolution, an intermediate state or condition, which obviously is pretty much where we are now in so many ways. It's not just the political limbo of the US election and the ongoing political limbo of Brexit, but perhaps also the relative calm before the real climate storm. Or as Antonio Gramsci put it, it goes, "The old is dying and the new cannot yet be born. And in this strange interregnum, a whole host of morbid symptoms arise." And perhaps that takes us to the other interpretation of limbo, which is a state of neglect or even oblivion, which is where a lot of the catastrophism perhaps starts to manifest itself.
Well, here's an interesting thing that I read this week in terms of the symptoms of the interregnum. And I picked it up because Anthony Barnett posted it on Facebook. And in fact, he's quoted in this piece. It's a review in The Economist of Rod Dreher's new book, Live Not by Lies. Andrea is an editor at the American Conservative. He's a self-described crunchy con, which I think you could summarize as a conservatism that is environmentally concerned, that is often religious, that is critical of capitalism in some aspects. He's best known for a book he wrote a few years ago called The Benedict Option, which was basically arguing that folks like him should stop engaging with contemporary politics and withdraw and create small communities like the monasteries created by St. Benedict. What struck me about this Economist piece is that it draws out the sense that people from quite different places politically have in common a feeling that this is a time where it's necessary to retreat, to withdraw. And so the reviewer says, plenty of believers in America and elsewhere share Mr. Dreher's sense of alienation, but his work resonates for another reason. Many others who disavow the rest of his worldview have confronted the basic choice that he lays out, participation or flight. Anthony Barnett, an English writer on democracy, observes a mood of retreat among older left-leaning people in England and America. Some over 50 are, he says, withdrawing from active politics into unideological passions such as gardening. The impulse, he thinks, derives less from fatalism than from an awareness that the job of fixing a broken system properly belongs to a younger, untarnished generation. The older cohort know they were part of the problem. So Anthony posted that on Facebook and he asked, do you know anyone withdrawing to wait and support the new generation while knowing that they permitted the rise of the disaster right? I guess I'm curious if that rings any bells for you, Ed.
Yeah, I think personally, perhaps, you know, I know that I've consciously stepped away from the madness of the news cycle in a very specific way over the last few years. And in order to create my own space for developing my own thoughts, feelings, and theories and practices, which aren't constantly, as you say, under a relentless bombardment. And you could argue that that is in some ways a form of retreat from the front line, but perhaps for some more thoughtful strategizing from a safer place.
There's another version of this retreat or withdrawal that I feel more aligned to than the Rod Dreher American Conservative version. It's what Gordon White from Rune Soup, the blog that we talked about earlier in the series, describes in terms of your personal Rivendell phase. He says, when I'm asked, what can we do? I know the expected answer is something like, form a group of bloggers and express an opinion about ecological degradation that no one even remotely important will ever notice. Start the Dark Mountain Project, for example. I don't know.
Exactly.
But the answer is that you're in a personal Rivendell phase. From the perspective of culture and civility, you need to be the last homely house east of the sea. However, with an emerging decentral opportunity, the stage is set for this to be literally true. You have the opportunity to literally create a local sphere of improvement, an Imladris or hidden valley. And so he's borrowing from Tolkien, who would have been pretty at home with the American Conservative school of politics, this image of creating a pocket of virtue or a pocket of what's worth creating in the world, what's worth living for. But this idea that actually change is going to come in a decentral fashion, such that these pockets might not be simply an abdication of responsibility, but might be another way of taking responsibility for the change that the world is calling for. And that brings me to something I read from Pat McCabe, Woman Stands Shining, who is a Diné mother, grandmother, an activist, an artist. And a few days before the election, she posted this. She said, I feel strangely calm. I spend almost no energy on national events. But then this is evidence of my lineage, at least in recent generations. The deepest, destructive machinations have been at work all around us, without regard for what the human heart is wired to perceive as most precious and vital. Children, elders, women, the honour of man. Also without regard for the instinct to preserve what makes life possible. Water, air, soil, fire, all the other members of the sacred hoop of life. The initial shock and horror of this darkness moving over the land and over the way of life was borne by my great-grandparents. It was further digested like the plastics now lining the whales' bellies by my grandparents, and then by my parents, now functional members of society, of this mad society, until today here I sit with little concern over what monster is being constructed over there in their dark laboratory of numbed blindness, false power and destitute wealth. I only hold that I will be shown a way to move through it. This is how my forebears walked through the valley of the shadow of death, fearing no evil, for centuries. So forgive me if I don't show appropriate panic or outrage or fear. I am trauma transcendent evolved now, holding the tenuous stream of possibility, a spider's thread, looking to weave this web into life again, whispering to my body, not necessarily designed for such tests of endurance, but still an adaptogen to this life, I whisper, shh, shh, soon, soon, just a little further, a little bit further. Creator is watching. You will see. And that's the kind of voice from the edge that speaks straight to me in a moment like this.
She is one incredible woman. I had the privilege of meeting her at the Findhorn New Story Summit a few years ago. She was equally extraordinary then in terms of her presence and connection. And I think perhaps that it's not necessarily a sense of limbo as such, but there's an element of dance to that, you know, of the in the stillness there being the dancing, as T.S. Eliot would say. The other kind of interpretation of limbo is in, obviously, the West Indian dance, which comes from a derivation in West Indian English from limber, to bend, which the dancer bends backwards to pass under a horizontal bar, which is then obviously progressively lowered to a position just above the ground. And it struck me as a very humbling image, actually. Not only from a personal perspective, if you ever tried to limbo under a low bar, but also the fact that you get closer and closer to the ground with each round, literally to the earth. Actually passing under the bar and then successfully raising your head is also symbolic of a spiritual transition. You know, it's the triumph of death back into life. And as I mentioned earlier, traditionally the bar started low and got higher and higher to represent that transition from death to life. And limbo was traditionally practiced as a funeral dance. I must admit, it's not at any funerals I've ever been to, mind, where someone has said, and now it's time to limbo. And the world record is actually 6 inches. So if you can try and comprehend going under a 6-inch high bar with your belly exposed to the heavens, then that would be a truly extraordinary thing.
I can't even imagine how that's anatomically possible.
No. But also, limbo is actually connected to the African Legba dance and the Haitian voodoo spirit Papa Legba, who's a trickster deity, and he's fond of riddles being one of the lower, which is the intermediary spirits that operate between Bondi, the good god, and the material living world. And Papa Legba appears as an old man on a crutch or with a cane, and he's wearing a broad brimmed straw hat and smoking a pipe or perhaps drinking sparkling water. And he always stands at the spiritual crossroads as a gatekeeper to either give or deny permission to speak to the spirit world. And in that sense, he's known as the great elocutioner. You know, he speaks every human language, and his role is to facilitate communication, to conduct speech and to bring understanding. And he walks with a limp because he walks in two worlds at once, the spirit world and the living world, the certain and the uncertain. And I think just culturally as well, we all know the story of the blues musician Robert Johnson, who apparently sold his soul to the devil. But actually, there's many interpretations say he didn't sell his soul to the devil. He sold it to Mr. Legba, Mr. Papa Legba, in exchange for his musical talents at the crossroads.
Well, there's something here, isn't there, that reaches back through lots of our conversations about the figure of the trickster, the crossroads, liminality, the edge. You know, at the center of Alan Garner's novels is Alderley Edge, called The Edge, where he grew up. And that sense that you mentioned from Martin Shaw of when the world is stuck, when there are no options left, when there are no moves left in the game, that the trickster figure who says, well, maybe we could just be playing a different game, comes from the edge, but doesn't stick with the safety of the purity of the edge. It's always the wild knight who walks into Camelot and lays down the challenge, sets in motion the play between the edges and the center, the dance of it all, that brings us through to the next chapter.
I love what you were saying about the crossroads element, because every good crossroads has a pub in order to water the weary traveller. And I do think it's worth just going back to the story of the Locks Inn, which we've mentioned a couple of times in this thread, which is not actually at a crossroads. It's at the end of a long dirt track, but it is at the edge of the river, which would have been the principal means of navigation and indeed transport and travel in the 17th century when it first became a pub from a lockkeeper's cottage. And we jokingly referred to the Locks Inn as the pub of the Long Now, but actually it happened. We saved it from limbo
with the help of your friend Mr. Eno.
Of course, I can't go a podcast episode without mentioning Brian. But there was a very real risk that this sort of 300-year-old pub would either be bought by a property developer who would then sit on it waiting for change of use in order to turn it into a fancy house, because it's an amazing building in an incredible location, right in the middle of the marshes, or, you know, becoming sort of Soho House by Waveney. But the navigation of the journey, which happened so fast over sort of 4 short weeks from some initial conversations to this mass mobilization of local people, to the incredible generosity of gifts, from the weird synchronicities of connections, you know, it was almost like a script unfolding in terms of how I bumped into Brian Eno on that day, having had the initial conversation. He then became one of our sort of public faces for the media, and describing his passion and commitment to the pub, to the fact that we managed to raise the funding, over £400,000 in order to preempt the auction, and buy the pub before other bidders had a chance to access it. And then this sort of roller coaster ride where the sitting tenant then committed an act of cultural vandalism by essentially stripping the pub of all its fixtures and fittings, all of its furniture, which had been there for decades, if not longer, including a stuffed pike, which had adorned the wall for longer than anyone can recall. But ultimately, I think this is a story of triumph, of initiative and collaboration, of being able to get through in what felt like an impossible timescale with impossible hurdles to secure the pub, hopefully for the next 300 years, to have our lock, stock and 2 frothing barrels of warm local ale. And for those of you who've ever visited the Waveney Valley will know the traditional pastime of dwile flonking, which is a game traditionally competed between 2 local towns, Bungay and Beccles, which involves flinging an ale-soaked rag at a girting ring of dancers.
Are we allowed to talk about dwile flonking before the watershed?
I'll put a link to a video of dwile flonking in the show notes, because it has to be seen to be believed.
Label it not safe for work. But I think it's worth dwelling on the pattern in the story of the Locks Inn there. And I'm really sorry to hear about this cultural vandalism in the middle of it. But we literally did a show where we talked about synchronicity, and this thing happened to you in the week running up to that show of talking about Mr. Eno and then running into him on the towpath. And you couldn't name him when we first spoke about this a few weeks ago. And then that all kind of wove into this thing that you describe as things coming together very quickly and serendipitously. Now, we're recording this on Thursday, the 5th of November, which is Guy Fawkes Night for those of us who grew up in the UK when we celebrate burning Catholics. It's also the birthday of the late John Bircher. And yesterday, which was literally in, you know, the first hours of the post-election limbo, I took the bus out to a very old place on the edge of the city where I live to meet a man from the internet. And again, this happened because of a chain of synchronicities. So I talked a couple of times about Rune Soup, this blog by this chaos magician in Tasmania called Gordon White. He posted a curious, strange post a few weeks ago about a trip that he and his partner had made to Tang Dimmer. It's a place in Tasmania which has a deep history of human habitation before the coming of settlers and the Tasmanian genocide. But it's also the birthplace of Bill Mollison, one of the originators of permaculture. And as Gordon describes it, it's certainly a place where the veil is thin. And I was reading about all of the different strange coincidences and chances within his trip there in the post. And then at the bottom of the post, there's a comment from a guy called Jens, who says, I went for a bicycle ride earlier today to Arnhems Høg, to the local ancient site with Sweden's largest burial mound. And I'm like, wait a minute, that's my local ancient site. It's 2 miles from where I live. It's a place that's hugely important to me, not just the burial mound, but actually the natural feature that is what drew people to that site, which is this thing called an orse. And I got interested in it because I was there visiting the burial mound, and on one of the signs it had this word, and then it translated it in the English text to ridge. And I'm looking at this thing and I'm going, this doesn't make sense to me what they're talking about, what they're calling a ridge. So I went home and looked it up. And an orse, the proper word for it in English is esker. And unless you've studied a particular kind of post-glacial geology and geography, you probably have never met that word, because we don't really have eskers in the British Isles. What it is, it's the ghost of a subglacial river. So you imagine, 20,000 years ago, there was 3 miles of ice on top of the landscape here where I live. And then over thousands of years, that ice is thawing, and under it you've got channels of water running through that are actually huge rivers. And like any river, you get a build-up over centuries of pebbles on the bottom, the riverbed, and you know how rivers silt up, so that gets higher and higher and higher, and meanwhile the water above it is still carving its channel through the ice. And then eventually, when the ice has melted and the river is gone, you're left with this structure that looks like a kind of great railway siding snaking for hundreds of miles across the landscape following the course of the old river. And it's the old riverbed, but it can be 60 meters or more high above the surrounding landscape. And there's quite extraordinary features. And when humans returned to this landscape after the ice, they used these features as the place for their paths. And so you can see the kind of hollow ways dug into the sides by generations of people with horses walking this line across the landscape. And it was only about 1,000 years ago that people began to shift to water-based transport rather than these as the means of communication across the Swedish landscape. And still to this day, in autumn, you see the migrating geese steering by the course of the esker, following it. And to me, it's this extraordinary image of the persistence of the past and the way in which the remnants of something that was over 10,000 years ago, the last ice age, continue to contribute in unanticipatable ways to the forms of life that exist now. And when I talk about turning to the past as a direction in which to ground myself on the days when the future feels too heavy a weight to put on our shoulders, that's one of the stories that I tell. So I met up with this guy, Jens. And of course, when I get in touch with him, like, we'd both been reading this blog for ages, and it was the first time he'd ever left a comment. And we get in touch, and it turns out that he was working with my partner, Anna, for a couple of years at the city council here. And there are all sorts of other serendipities around it. And we went for a walk yesterday afternoon, talked about learning to trust the synchronicities, learning to notice the door that is being opened when something like that happens to you. And also learning to listen to and trust the places that have a particular feel to them. You know, Alan Garner says somewhere about the edge. He says, you know, you get all of these goths coming out on Halloween to prance up and down and do these made up rituals. If they just sit still and listen, they might learn something. There are hospitable places. There are places I know in the landscape here that have helped me begin to ground myself in Sweden. And part of what works about these places is they're places that have known humans for a long time. I don't pretend to understand how it works, but there is a sense of hospitality, even of being offered refuge by certain places in certain landscapes.
And that idea of refuge is also a transient one, isn't it? I think, you know, returning to that sense of limbo, we often use the term legal limbo to describe the irregular migrants that perhaps we're already experiencing and are likely to see more of in the future, who are caught in that state of limbo, arriving in a country or in a place without being legally or forcibly removed, but nor being granted refugee status and thus being deprived of basic rights. And we see that with these camps which are springing up across the fringe of Europe, where people are sort of being held in this sort of legal limbo.
And this is how climate change arrives in small boats washing up on holiday beaches.
Exactly, exactly. And I think there's also that sense of limbo in the film Inception, you know, which is one of those movies which, you know, literally works on so many unfathomable levels. But in that, limbo is portrayed as an infinite space of raw consciousness, which manifests as an endless ocean. And it's a shared dream space where any dreamer can make drastic and dramatic alterations to the dream. You know, literally the imagery that is conjured is utterly mind-boggling in terms of the multidimensional possibilities. But the film also strikes a real note of caution, because when you are in limbo, you can forget you're in limbo and therefore be unable to wake up, to extract yourself from the dream and essentially become lost in limbo. And for me, with this sort of final episode, you know, we inevitably try and weave a few threads together. I think that state of limbo creates interesting reflections on the other altered states that we've been exploring over the last 7 or 8 weeks. You know, we looked at the state of alert, the state of grace, the state of panic, the state of tension, the state of anger, state of play and state of jeopardy. And I think for me, limbo, after all of those states, limbo is not unattractive. That space at the edge where we have a foot in both worlds, perhaps a place which goes beyond the polarized tribalism that can feel so fierce and urgent and pressurizing, but also a space of uncertainty that contains actually rich possibility. And I think in that context, you know, there's actually an enormous amount of learning to be had in limbo. You know, you can feel like you're stranded there, but actually there are great insights to be garnered from the benefit of that Elysium, but you don't want to stay there forever.
It's like Martin says, don't make a marginal life out of a marginal experience. Garner the insights and then do something with them. And there is this thread here about refuge. And now I'm thinking again of Emma Wallace, who I quoted a few weeks ago, talking about the artist and the monk. And she has this extraordinary thing, refugi, a deep adaptation mountain monastery for holy rebels, sacred fools, and radical artists that she's been creating over the last 10 years or so in the Cathar Mountains of the Pyrenees, a historical hotbed of heresy. It's a kind of monasticism that I feel more at home with than the Rod Dreher version. But I guess you've broken the story about the pub of the long now, and before we wrap up this series, it's my turn to break a story. Because while all of that was coming together that you've been involved in, after 2.5 years of a very privileged kind of limbo, Anna and I have found a place to call home, a house that can accommodate a school. It's in a town called Östervåla, which is about 30 miles northwest of Uppsala. The house was built in 1912 as the shoemakers for this small town. And it's been in the same family since then to now. So last week I spent a day there and we were sort of walking around with these two men who are coming up for 70, who were born there and grew up there. And the one guy then moved back after a few years away and has been running it until 5 years ago as the town shoe shop. So the downstairs space has been a shoe shop and will become workshop or whatever it is, a space where we can start the work we're doing as a school, and we'll live over the shop. And then there's a big red barn in the garden that will become the schoolhouse over time as we work on it. And it feels like there's an incredible amount of work ahead. Feels almost a little bit embarrassing at a moment where things are going back into lockdown, where there's so much bad news and so on, to be excited about something, to have some good news about this. And yet maybe people really need good news. We really need the promise that there are going to be places to gather when it becomes easier to cross borders and to gather around tables again. And so I like to think that what we're doing is an act of faith in that. But I have to tell you about some of the serendipities by which it came into our lives, because this happened incredibly quickly as well after this long limbo and various false starts. And what happened was I was on the first of these calls that I'd been doing with Vanessa Andreotti and this collection of activists and Indigenous knowledge keepers and academics who've been gathering once a week for an evening called Preparing for the End of the World as We Know It. And Anna was sat, she cleared out all of the searches that we had saved on Hemnet, which is the site you use in Sweden when you're looking for a property. She set up a new one, and it just felt in hindsight like this moment of resetting the intentions. And 2 days later, up pops this property, which looks kind of interesting. And she looks at it and she says, well, hang on a minute, because it says that there's going to be a viewing on the 31st of October between midnight and midnight. And she sends a message to the estate agent and says, well, could you tell me what time the viewing is actually going to be? And he calls her straight back and says, well, would you like to come this weekend? And so that Sunday, we rent a car and drive out there and spend some time at this house, being shown around by this guy who himself grew up in the town and moved away and moved back. And he used to rent an apartment in the house next door. He sold the house opposite to the guy who lives there, and their daughters play together on the football team. And just this very unlike the experiences we've had over the last couple of years of going to look at properties. And the next morning we put in an offer for the asking price and we had it accepted that evening. And so in 4 days we went from not knowing about this place to signing a contract for it. And it was only afterwards that I realized, hang on a minute, midnight on the 31st of October. That's the most liminal moment in the year. That's when the old Celtic year ended. It's Samhain. So there was some Yeah, I always say you have to sort of treat these things as a joke the world joined in with rather than take them terribly seriously and so on, because otherwise that way madness lies. But there's some trickster spirit at work in the weave of all of this.
That's wonderful.
And the only reason we need something larger than the two-bedroom apartment that we're renting at the moment is to be a place of hospitality where we can bring people together and convene conversations and do our little bit of the work that might contribute to the possibilities for what comes next in the times ahead. And, you know, I'm more of a Garner man than a Tolkien man. But it does feel like taking up Gordon White's invitation to make your own Rivendell, your own homely house, not as some cold and mountainous detachment from the world, but as a seedbed, one small pocket among many pockets that might just join together. There's a story that I first heard sitting around the table at Alan Garner's house years ago from one of the archaeologists that he works with. They said, well, you know, at the end of the last ice age, we used to think that things like the oak tree had survived in these southern refuges of southern Greece and Turkey and then sort of fanned out, marching across the continent like an army on a map or like a plan for a grand revolution. And then the palynologists, the people who study ancient seeds and pollen, started finding things in times and places where they shouldn't be in the record. Acorns where they couldn't possibly have got there that way. And so the new theory is this thing called cryptic northern refugia. They are cryptic because they're pockets that are so small that you would miss them in the record. They don't seem significant enough to have played a role. They're northern because they're much further north than you thought a species had survived. And they're refugia because they are refuges, pockets of life in an inhospitable landscape. And so now they think that when this dramatic climate change that happened at the end of the last ice age took place, it was from these pockets that the landscape was reseeded with oak trees and apple trees and strawberries and, you know, with human hands helping the seeds nuts along their way. That's how we got life again after this time of deep inhospitability. And I always come back to that as an image of what it might mean to be taking responsibility for a little pocket of life in the times that we find ourselves in.
And actually that weaves very well into the bit I wanted to conclude my contribution to our collaboration on this series of conversations with, which is actually a little quote from a 1981 movie called My Dinner with Andre, which some people might be familiar with, but it's written by and starring Wallace Shawn, who some of you will recognise as a very well-known actor, but perhaps most famously in The Princess Bride, which is another memorable film.
Splendid film.
But this, My Dinner with Andre is pretty self-explanatory. It's two theatre workers basically having a dinner conversation. And there's just this moment where Andre is describing the adventures and explorations that he's been having, which actually are very humbling. But he says this, he goes, "See, I think it's quite possible that the 1960s represented the last burst of the human being before he was extinguished. And that from now on, there'll be all these robots walking around, feeling nothing, thinking nothing. And there'll be nobody left almost to remind them that once was a species called a human being with feelings and thoughts, and that history and memory are right now being erased, and soon nobody will really remember that life existed on the planet, and that we're probably going back to a very savage, lawless, terrifying period. Findhorn people see it a little differently, a feeling that there'll be these pockets of light springing up in different parts of the world, and these will be, in a way, invisible planets on this planet, and that we, or the world, grow colder, we can take invisible space journeys to these different planets and refuel for what it is we need to do on the planet itself and come back. And it's their feeling that there have to be centres now where people can come and reconstruct a new future for the world, that actually these centres are growing up everywhere now, and that what we're trying to do is creating a new kind of school or a new kind of monastery. Islands of safety where history can be remembered and the human being can continue to function in order to maintain the species through a dark age. In other words, we're talking about an underground, which did exist in a different way during the Dark Ages among the mystical orders of the Church. And the purpose of this underground is to find out how to preserve the light, life, the culture, how to keep things living. You see, I keep thinking that what we need is a new language, a language of the heart, some kind of language between people that is a new kind of poetry. That's the poetry of the dancing bee that tells us where the honey is. And I think that in order to create that language, you're going to have to learn how you can go through a looking glass into another kind of perception, where you have that sense of being united to all things, and suddenly you understand everything. And so I think, for me, that infinite space of raw consciousness, revealed as an endless ocean in Inception, is the space of limbo and the state of limbo where those fertile seeds might begin to be nurtured.
Well, that does kind of wrap things up. I mean, this is us at the end of our second series. We'll be back in the new year, by which time we might even know who the President of the United States is. But meanwhile, in this episode, we've had Garner and we've had Tolkien. So I'm going to finish with a bit of C.S. Lewis. And I picked this up from L.M. Sarkassus's wonderful newsletter, The Convivial Society. And if you're one of those virtuous pagans and the Christian bit in this passage sticks in your throat, then imagine it reworded in a language that speaks to you. But I think there's a message here that speaks to this moment. It is one of the evils of rapid diffusion of news that the sorrows of all the world come to us every morning. I think each village was meant to feel pity for its own sick and poor whom it can help, and I doubt if it is the duty of any private person to fix his mind on ills which he cannot help. This may even become an escape from the works of charity we really can do to those we know. A great many people do now seem to think that the mere state of being worried is in itself meritorious. I don't think it is. We must, if it so happens, give our lives for others. But even while doing it, I think we're meant to enjoy our Lord and in him our friends, our food, our sleep, our jokes, and the bird song and the frosty sunrise. As about the distant, so about the future. It is very dark, but there's usually light enough for the next step or so.
Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. We see this podcast as very much an exploration, not a prescription. A provisional investigation that maybe loves questions more than answers to begin with and needs a little time and space to breathe. If you are new to the podcast, please do revisit season one, as we are aiming to build on ideas, insights, and narratives already touched upon. And together, this will hopefully enable us all to make a little more sense of these strange times we are living through. Please do comment, ask questions, and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or via my Twitter account, @Frucall. And we would obviously deeply appreciate and be grateful for any ratings, reviews, recommendations or sharing you might feel compelled to contribute as a result of listening. Our title music is I Recall by Blue Dot Sessions, used gratefully under a Creative Commons license. We're living in a time of humbling, an initiation at a cultural scale. Please join us on this emergent journey.